Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
At the Races with Steve Bick. Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
We're back, hour three, a minute or two in, and just was talking off air to Ed Martin from RCI, Racing Commissioners International, and there was nobody else to call last week after the HISA budgetary suggestions or requests, parameters were laid out, and how they're going to be, how they're being received by the state commissions and the ramifications. You know, there was the press release, but there's been very little other communication from HISA, and this has been their MO essentially, to set off a concussion bomb and, you know, then let everybody deal with the fallout. Ed Martin, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
Ed,
still standing over there.
I kept threatening everybody that you were going to join us, and you've had a lot of travel, and you've been bouncing back and forth between Kentucky, Arizona, and so forth, dealing with what is going to be the realities of this. Alan Foreman, I had Alan actually the day before the press release about the budget, and Alan sort of said there's going to be fits and starts and there's going to be frustrations, and we all understand that, but this is a little bit different. This was the shoe that everybody was waiting to drop to understand where the the financial underpinnings were going to be and how it was going to interface with the regulatory bodies. Explain as best you can, because there appears to be real confusion about it. But in an ideal world, how would this $72 million budget work?
Well, first of all, let's go back to when Congress passed the bill. What the Congress essentially did is they privatized a significant part of horse racing regulation. And they put it in the hands of a private organization, which is structured, it's the same legal structure as the ARCI is. It's a not-for-profit 501c6, but it was empowered by federal statute, and it operates under some kind of loose supervision of the Federal Trade Commission, which really has not gotten involved in anything that they have done. It gave them a taxing authority. And they have operated completely behind closed doors. Unlike a racing commission budget, they're put together in public. There are hearings. You can see exactly who gets paid what and where the money goes and how the vendors are chosen and who's going to pay. The states have tried to advise HISA throughout the process on ways to maximize the money that is currently being appropriated by the states and the infrastructure that is already in place. And it is their prerogative not to listen to a lot of that. And they're very, very nice folks, and they listen politely, and they thank us for our input, and then they go behind closed doors and do what they do. This is an assessment on the industry. Now, there is a mechanism in the federal statute where a state can opt in to pay the assessment or raise taxes in their state to pay the assessment. We had a meeting of pretty much every state the other day to get some initial reaction as to what everybody's intent was on this. And I will tell you that it's really no different than it was on the last time they levied an assessment, and that is most states did left it to HISA. And that's probably going to happen again. There's a couple of states who opted in to pay the HISA assessment the last time. There may actually be fewer states this time. In some cases, some of the regulatory agencies said the HISA assessment was larger than their overall budget. That's not a surprise. There are two new layers. There's the layer of HISA, and then there's the layer of the Horse Integrity Welfare Unit. So the cost of this is going to fall on the tracks, and they released a list of all the tracks and a HISA fee that would be allocated on a per start basis. That doesn't mean it's going to be it could be a per start fee on anybody, you know, racing a horse every time they race a horse at Oaklawn. That according to their chart, it's $408 per start fee. You get into Kentucky, it's interesting. You've got a $552 per start fee at Keeneland and a $1,057 per start fee at Kentucky Downs. I don't really understand how that happens. Turfway is going to have a $189 per start fee. I'm not sure. I mean, I don't think anybody should overreact to these numbers right now. It's early. I mean, there's going to be negotiations with states, and if there's a state that could use state money, this existing state authority they have to assess people funds, it might be Kentucky. That has to play out through their process. But a lot of states don't have the money and don't think they're going to be able to pay this. So the cost is going to fall on the tracks and the horsemen. So all I can say is, you know, they must have wanted to get this out before Breeders' Cup. But the one thing that sits in my mind, Steve, is this bill was the exercise of raw political power by the leadership in both the House and the Senate, and particularly Senate Minority Leader or Majority Leader at the time, Mitch McConnell. And we've got the Breeders' Cup coming here to Kentucky, and which is where I'm at right now. And when they passed that bill, it was in a COVID relief bill of mm-hmm. over $1 trillion. Mm-hmm. And I know I've said this before, in a federal bill of over $1 trillion, where they're throwing and spending money out the window like there's no tomorrow, and they're using it for all sorts of stuff, not just COVID stuff. It's hidden in a COVID relief bill, but not one penny for horse racing. And then to get a bill like this, you know, to be honest with you, if Mitch McConnell shows up at Breeders' Cup and anybody's concerned about this, the fact that he didn't deliver one penny for horse racing and shoved this bill through, you should turn your back on it. We've had the National Racing Compact, which does multi-state licensing, and they talk to horsemen every day, okay? So I'm talking to the staff here this morning, and I said, what are you hearing on HISA? They asked me, what are you hearing on HISA? And I said, well, you know, a lot of people are concerned about the cost. He says, we can't find anybody who has anything good to say about it. And so how many people have you talked to? He says, we've talked to thousands of horsemen call us over the past few months. Some people may not want to stand up and say anything publicly, but boy, they're saying it privately.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, there's good people over there working for HISA, and they're trying their hardest with the deadlines, but the deadline was unrealistic. This is a rush job. And it's like watching sausage be made, but it's also the economic cost of this at a time of high inflation and people worrying about heating their homes and you know, feeding their families. And what impact is that going to have on the entertainment dollar, let alone people who are marginal already in this sport? This sport is a lot bigger than just Central Kentucky. And while it may be fine in Kentucky, you know, there's a lot of people all across this country who are very concerned about what's going to happen to thoroughbred racing going forward.
Address that from your perspective, Ed, because nobody knows the pressures and the machinations of the regulatory bodies more than you or better than you. And what are the next steps? I mean, was this yet another floated, negotiation balloon that then gets massaged? Talk about the collection credit. Because there was some murmurings that, you know, for those that were worried that it exceeded their budgets, well, you'll get the credit and it'll fall right, you know, within your parameters. Maybe you'll have to go into your pocket a little bit. Explain what you understand their thinking to be.
I think if I had to say what the biggest mistake that HISA has made throughout this entire process is they make assumptions. They just make assumptions. And those are not necessarily correct assumptions. It's because they would like it to be a certain way, but it doesn't mean that that's realistic. There are all sorts of issues. And one of them is the fact that the law takes this out of the state's hands effective January 1st. And everybody knows that. And they really only want the states to, you know, run a test barn. That's really all they want the states to do. They have created a program. You know, hindsight's always 2020. I mean, we had a board meeting. The RCI had a board meeting in July, and after that board meeting, I asked the HISA representative who we were talking to for the opportunity to talk to the HISA board, and I've never been given that opportunity. And one of the things I would have said is, it's early enough. You know, you may want to consider some alternatives that might help you and help the industry. But they obviously didn't want that input, and that's okay. That's their right. I don't have a horse in this race, except, you know, when you care about this sport and you care about the people in it, you're just extremely concerned about what the future is going to hold for them. But. You know, maybe Senator McConnell can pluck $50 million out of a hat in the final days of a lame duck Congress here. And that would be great. But I'm not anticipating that or expecting that. And I don't even know that anybody has asked them for that. Well, that'd be a good question to ask HISA. Well, have you asked Mitch McConnell for an appropriation?
Or
are you just telling everybody on Capitol Hill that everything's going great?
Well,
which I think is what's happening.
So, Ed, it's let's see. It's October 26th.
Yes, it is.
What's going to transpire January 1st?
Well, this budget takes effect. Somebody's going to have to start paying the HISA bill. The way it looks like... they're going to the burden is going to probably fall mostly on the tracks and the horsemen, and however the tracks choose to pass those costs along. And HISA takes total control over all the anti-doping testing, collections, investigations, prosecutions, and adjudications starting January 1. There's some open logistical issues that they're going to try to negotiate with the states. I have no read as to how that's going to play out. There are some states who will probably get completely out of running running the test barn. There are other states that may help them on a on an interim basis till they get on their feet. I mean, nobody wants to see them fail. We're, you know, a lot of people are just scratching their heads, saying, you know, there's you really put this together in a way that we don't really understand your thinking, why you're making it so much harder on yourself and frankly more costly on the industry. But that's what they did.
Well, and that's been the point that was made most notably well in advance at first. Alan Foreman kept trying to wave that flag, as did Eric Hamelbeck. Alan, at a certain point, and the THA kind of felt like they had to throw in. HBPA and Eric Hamelbeck have continued to say we didn't need to reinvent the wheel. There were things that that the industry was eager to have assistance on, didn't need to start from scratch. One of the things that amazed me in the reporting last week, Ed, and I'd love you to comment on this, the concept that there's going to be less testing of actual winners and horses that have placed, and random horses. I thought that was pretty stunning. And I guess I'm sure critics of the current, the status quo, quote unquote, are going to say, well, we're not catching anybody anyway with testing, so what's the point of doing all the testing that we're doing? I would disagree about that.
You are testing people. You are testing, and you're catching people. And you're catching people at the same rate they catch people in the Olympics, and at the same rate they catch people in any of WADA-regulated sports. So this off-the-cuff kind of comment to justify, and I am not familiar with what their plans are. Believe it or not, they have not included me or us in the development of their program. It's going to be, they haven't included a lot of the state racing commissions in their program. I know they've been meeting, the HIWU people have been meeting individually with the states. The feedback I get is there's not a lot of details. So I can't comment on what their program is or is not going to be. The only thing I can say is, at the end of the day, I'm assuming we're going to know how many horses are tested and how many horses come back with a violation, and what the results of those violations are. Because you know something? If you put all of this behind a curtain of darkness and then tell everybody everything's okay, yeah, there are some people that might believe it, but you've lost a real measure to understand, is this, for all the new cost, has it been worth all the money? Now, I'm sure their $360,000 a year PR firm is going to say it is, because they're getting paid a lot of money to say that. So, you know, I'm sure if this industry spent $360,000 talking about how good it was, we wouldn't have been in this mess. But, you know, this industry decided to hire PR firms to talk about how bad it was, because they basically wanted to privatize this function, and they succeeded.
Well, and those of us that are of a certain mindset will say that this entire exercise distills down to the desire to eliminate Lasix, and for that we're going to pay the price of driving owners out of the game, and perhaps, I mean, we'll still wait and see about any attempt to bilk owners further and horse players further is going to be met with absolute revolt and disgust and an exodus. We've said for years, Ed, I haven't said it with you per se, but this was always a class war. And from word go, this was a class war, and the people that are, as you say, operating under, you know, under cover of night and a cloak of darkness, they'll be quite delighted when a certain percentage of stakeholders and participants and players turn away from the game, because it's basically going to be priced to a point where only the elite are going to be able to participate. And that's what Stuart Janney's wanted for an indefinite period.
Well, I can't speak for what Mr. Janney has wanted or not wanted. I do know he's wanted a good testing program, and I know he's wanted some uniformity across the system. There's ways to do that without, you know, there's a lot less costly ways to achieve what I think the proponents of the initial HISA Act wanted to achieve. But it was a slam dunk. It was a Christmas tree ornament on a Christmas tree COVID relief bill that was going through. It was a must-pass piece of legislation. And nobody really paid a whole lot of attention to it except the sponsors and their staffs and the people who were advocating for it. There were a lot of people who were not at the table in how to put it together. It didn't go through regular order, which is usually when you get everybody who's affected by it in a room and you try to figure out and say, we're going to do this. Now let's do something that's actually going to work. But they never had those discussions. And that's why we called for, you know, a technical correction. And, you know, there's people who just look at us calling for a technical correction to this statute, saying, they just ignore it, we won, we got it, we don't see any need for a technical correction. Well, maybe some of these racetracks that sat on the side and didn't say anything or signed on to this bill, who all of a sudden are facing these huge bills, might want to say, maybe we do need a technical correction. But I'll tell you this much, once the states get out of doing this, I think it's going to be very hard to go backwards at any point in the future. So once they get out of it, I don't think the states are ever coming back. So if a state gives up its test barn or gives up its prosecutors who have never lost a drug case in their entire career, and there's a lot of people like that, because, you know, our testing has shown across the network, you know, there were maybe 1,000 medication violation cases in the United States every year, and that's all breeds. And with very few exceptions, as a state racing commission and their prosecutors lose a case, very few. But they chose not to rely on any of that, to rebuild something, to build something new and different. It never really was a partnership in putting the program together. Really, at the end of the day, they really would like to have the states collect urine and blood for them. And then maybe if they need an investigator to go toss a stall or a shed row should a violation come back. But I can't tell you that those investigators are still going to be paid for by the state and they're full time as they are now. You think you could just reimburse somebody for a day and then the state's going to pay for them for a year? I mean, come on. These aren't realistic assumptions. But, you know, they make assumptions. So, you know, they have it. And there's good people there. There's smart people there. Lisa Lazarus, I have the utmost respect for. I think she's she's been handed some things by her board that she's just trying to make work.
Sure.
But at the end of the day, to do all this in a cloak of, it reminds me of the old get smart days. I know I'm aging myself, Steve, where they used to have the cone of silence, you know, everybody gets in the cone of silence and we talk about what we're going to do. Well, does anybody look in the mirror and say, did we do it right? Or, you know, who's the Dutch uncle to come in and say, you may want to consider these other options, because these other options can get you to where you're trying to get to. But to our knowledge, I don't know if any of that's happened.
A couple of things. The the budget, the assessment that you suggested, any idea how that was derived? I floated that a few minutes ago about the potential for credits against against the budget. The per starts. I mean, how was I'm looking at this and I mean there's no formulation per se, Ed. And is there anything in this format that's comparable in under the existing operations?
Well, you know, we're sitting here trying to understand why New Mexico gets a race day credit for collecting samples of $107 per starter, and Pennsylvania gets one that's $69. Iowa gets one that's $95. Indiana gets one that's $65. And I don't understand, because, you know, the amount of purses has absolutely nothing to do with what it costs you to collect samples and run a test barn. Okay? Whether that horse is a million-dollar horse or a claimer, okay? Your costs are the same. You have to hire somebody to collect the samples, to supervise the samples. You need a supervising vet to draw blood. I mean, you know, these are just your costs. But, you know, I can't explain that. And that's for they're going to probably be asked that when they get into negotiations with the state. I'm sure they'll be prepared and able to answer it. But whether everybody is going to buy into it, it's a hard sell.
What is the status, and is there potential for stakeholders and you know concerned parties to rally behind that House Resolution 9132, which calls for delayed implementation?
Well, I haven't paid too much attention to what's going on in Washington. I've kind of assumed that nothing's going to happen in Washington, but the only way something would happen in Washington is if the tracks decided to kick up a storm and say, let's put Humpty Dumpty back together, perhaps in a different way. I don't think anybody's challenging the concept of having a HISA, of having a national uniformity program, of having a better out of competition testing program, expanded jurisdiction over the horses. A lot of great stuff in that bill. But, you know, hindsight's 2020, and I think this was put together with the best of intentions. But, you know, not having public work sessions where people can come in and voice concerns or give suggestions in a public way, you isolate yourself from the people. And, you know, this is almost, I hate to say it, somebody said this to me yesterday. They said, you know, we're worried about communists in coming in, that America's going communist, okay? It's kind of a bigger political thing. He says, I think that's what HISA is. It's communism for horse racing. And I said, I don't know. I'm not ready to go there. But the idea of handing down edicts and not doing it in public and letting people see how people are voting and how, you know, and just assuming you have all the answers and tuning out the people who are in the field, especially in organizations that are structured by statute to bring in people who have absolutely no experience in horse racing. You know, with all due respect to this guy Birch, who runs the anti-doping committee, to my knowledge, he hasn't had a substantive discussion with anybody who's been involved in the anti, maybe with the exception of Mary Scalay and Scott Stanley, who are on his committee. But he hasn't talked to any regulator who's prosecuted these cases or had to hear these cases or so forth. And, you know, we've invited him to RCI meetings, and we don't even get a courtesy of a response. So, for whatever that's worth, but I guess, you know, the NFL, try to find out, he used to run the NFL's program. Try to find out anything about the NFL's program. try to find out anything about the NFL's program, and you will frustrate yourself trying to get any details on it. And maybe that's what people want for horse racing. If nobody really knows, and nobody will think anybody's everything, and, you know, everybody's telling everybody it's fine. Well, you know, they're telling us our energy supplies, and we have no inflation problems, too. It's not fine.
No. I was hoping, Ed, you'd provide a little bit of a roadmap here for you know, kind of a way out of the miasma. I suppose that some of this will get massaged at symposium when we're together at University of Arizona.
The only people who can fix this, unless a court decides to stop it, the only people who can fix it is the HISA board. And as long as the HISA board stays locked behind closed doors and doesn't meet in public, and it's not, you know, it would seem to me that, you know, nobody wants to be embarrassed. And unfortunately, you've gone down this road, and to make any major changes, I can understand why they would want to kind of barrel down and just get it up and running.
Yeah.
And that's their choice, you know. I'm not going to criticize them. I think they were handed an extremely aggressive timeline. And I don't think anybody fully appreciated the enormity of it. We've tried to help them. You can lead a hiss of the water. You can't make it drink. So, you know, what are you going to say?
Observing the Texas situation, which is already heavily influenced Sam Houston Race Park and their anticipated 23 season with some date cutbacks and, you know, the cautionary approach that SHRP is taking with Texas essentially cutting itself off from simulcast opportunity. What do you make of that, and you know, what's a potential way forward in Texas?
Well, I don't have all the specifics, but I am being told, and I can't quantify this, I am being told that there have been some stables that have actually moved, I think one from Kentucky and one from Pennsylvania, that have recently moved into Texas to avoid the regulatory costs associated with operating. Whether that is indicative of anything larger, I don't know. I mean, that is certainly a decision that any state can make. The impact on, and I'm sure the tracks are involved in those discussions. That is one strategy. There's, I believe Wyoming is taking an approach like that. Texas is taking an approach like that. It doesn't mean that, I'm not aware of any others, but, you know, obviously some smaller states, if they have alternative revenues, possibly it makes it easier for them to do that. What that does, you know, to HISA, it's just one less state they need to worry about. They're pretty smart people down there, and they have a pretty good handle as to what they're trying to do. And I know they're very committed to the Texas horse industry, they've done some moves. I thought they were pretty courageous moves, but you know, they're the chairman down there is a really smart guy, and he thinks this is. Might be the best path for the Texas horse industry. So, we'll see.
Well, Ed, I appreciate the opportunity to get some feedback. I wanted you to maybe assuage some concerns and help people connect the dots. I mean, I read Matt Hegarty's piece three times and you know, got a headache, essentially.
I know I called Matt, and Matt's initial piece, he said the states, the states would pay the assessment unless they opted out. I said, no, you've got it completely backwards. The states are automatically out. They would have to affirmatively opt in to pay anything. And the states don't have to do anything. And that is the underscore that HISA never really, they just assumed everybody was going to pay and everybody was going to continue doing what they were doing, and they were going to hand the rulings down and hand the rules down. And there might have been a better way to put that together if that's what you were trying to accomplish. But it's like when the first bill came out, we assessed it and we analyzed it and we said, you know, what they're trying to do is fix the kitchen by burning the whole house down. And, you know, that's I stand by that analysis.
Well, that this was preceded by a decade of carpet bombing horsemen. By basically challenging the competency of horsemen and trying to characterize them as drug-addled buffoons. This was the approach of the Jockey Club to basically make people for a decade believe that that it was just a collection of half-wits and thieves. So congratulations, you managed to sully pretty much everybody in doing so, and then proceed to provide an apparatus that I think actually I saw this in a film. For those of you that have seen Brazil, this is where we are. Pull up Brazil. You'll get a glimpse of the future. In more than one way. Ed Martin, always a pleasure. We will talk next at Breeders' Cup, but I will talk to you. We will revisit all of this undoubtedly when we're together at Symposium.
Be sure to wave at Senator McConnell.
Oh, he'll get the same waves that Ted Cruz got in Yankee Stadium.
You be well. I'll see you later.
Ed Martin, everybody. And it's funny because those of you that don't know Ed and his radio show history, Ed and I are about as diametrically opposed politically as you're going to find. But yet we're certainly on the same page on this situation. I really appreciate Ed Martin and what he brought to this. I thought maybe that we would get a little bit more of an instructive path forward than we got from Ed. So unbelievable. Seth Merrow is standing by and he's always standing by. He's either standing by at the racetrack or on the set of Capital OTB, or maybe he's standing by at Desperate Annie's. Good morning.
I haven't been at Desperate Annie's in quite a while.
You know, I was thinking of you the other day. I almost sent you a picture. I know you do listen to the show regularly, so you know that I provided Tina late last week with a mock Thanksgiving, sort of a Thanksgiving run through, sort of a dry run for Thanksgiving. And I tried a new dish, which is not going to make the cut, which was a Creole green bean, which was too spicy. But I made a hot turkey sandwich, Seth, and I said, oh my God, I should send a picture of this to Seth Merrow, folks. If you want to watch a guy like in the old cartoons when the wolf's mouth opens and the tongue rolls out, put a hot turkey sandwich in front of him.
I do love the hot turkey sandwich. I eat turkey probably three times a week. Love turkey. Love the hot turkey sandwich. Yeah, so I saw pictures on Twitter, and I thought, oh, wow, kicking off Thanksgiving a little early. And I will say, it looked really, really good. Because I'm all about Thanksgiving. I love Thanksgiving dinner. But then even better, the hot turkey sandwich the day after.
Well, there was something else that I'm trying to do. You know, there's not a chef alive, amateur or even pro. Well, I suppose the pros, I'm sure they have no, I'm sure there's no holes in their game. But I have never, and I mean never, felt confident about my ability to make gravy with any consistency. It's maddening. And for whatever reason, I suppose I should have actually, it's one area where it's such a forgotten last thing, you know, you do all the other work and there's so many other things that you're involved with. In terms of timing, the most difficult aspect for those that are going to make Thanksgiving dinner, we discussed this with Neil Kleinberg, is the timing, getting everything out with all the dishes, getting everything out hot at the same time. And it's a challenge. And I mean, these days I've got technically now three ovens. I've got, you know, the new oven, which has got two layers, and then I got the old oven in the basement. So I've now got, you know, something extra at my disposal. But the one thing that invariably is a, you know, the last second, last thing cooked is gravy. And I screw it up over and over and over again. And so that was my goal last week, was to get, and I was happy with it, but I still didn't think it was perfect.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, though, in the professional chefs. If you're doing it every day, I would think you maybe have it down. But most people, and from experience as a guy who is, people know I like the hot turkey, so I get invited for Thanksgiving or just the turkey dinner occasionally at places. And so for the people who cook it once or twice or three times a year, it is inconsistent. You can get the lumpy gravy, and then the next time out, it's perfect. And so, yeah, it is a little bit inconsistent. But that just, as I say, goes down to the fact that a lot of people aren't going to have the turkey dinner two or three times a year.
Yeah, this was irresistible. In fact, I was out at Ushak's in Salem yesterday, in Shushan, and I was talking with Denny about having made this turkey. And I did it because I walked past the coffin cooler at Hannaford, and there's turkeys 99 cents a pound, and I was like, you got to be kidding me. And they can't raise the turkey for 99 cents a pound. I said to Denny, I said, how do they? He said it might have been last year's. And you think to yourself, yeesh, well, if it's in a deep freezer, all I know is I thawed that for 4 days. I just did garlic butter rub like I always do, and you know, lemon, lime, orange, celery, onion, and seasoning in the cavity, and you know, the garlic schmear under the skin, and this was as delicious a bird and as moist a bird. I don't care if it was last year's frozen bird or not. It was as good as anything I've paid, you know, $5 a pound for, you know, $75, $80 birds. I bought this $16 bird for $16. And it was great.
I haven't looked, but reading in the last month or so, I thought it was going to be slim pickings for turkeys. They were going to be expensive. So that you found one like that is great. And I will also, I know the answer to this, but I'll also ask, because I have occasionally, because I like turkey, I will fire up and cook my own occasionally. Do you ever use the bag? I'm big on the bag. Bag's easy.
I did roast a bird in a bag once. Because of size opportunity, when there was only, I think, like maybe four of us, so we got a smaller bird. My tendency is, you know, for a 16 to 20 pound bird, and in Canada, when I introduced American Thanksgiving dinner in my years living in Montreal, I would go down to the Atwater Market. I'd get like I can remember cooking. I smoked Sebastian and I smoked a 27-pound fresh turkey basically almost 24 hours on the porch. And boy, do we, I mean, we had so much fun. People coming by, and you know, we were out in the backyard, and I had this, it wasn't really a smoking, officially a smoking smoker. It was a sort of an oblong shaped grill that I bought at club price and for nothing. And I just basically kept smoldering, the smoldering wood on the two extreme ends of the oblong. And it was a potchke. It was a big deal. I had to brine the bird and do all that. But it was, I did it with star anise. It was unbelievable how good it was. And then when we made soup out of it, the smoke had permeated the bone. And so the turkey soup had this smoky undertone that was just, it was unbelievable. But that was like a 27 pound bird. But I can appreciate the poultry in a bag concept.
Yeah, like I say, very easy. Last year, I just bought a turkey breast at Thanksgiving. Well, last year I had COVID at Thanksgiving, so I was kind of locked down. But I had already bought the breast, and I popped it in a slow cooker. Ooh, that was good. The meat fell right out. Yeah,
wow.
It was very good. But like I say, it was just a breast. It was just enough for me and a few hot turkey sandwiches later on. So
well,
that was very good.
Well, for our friend Dave Joseph. For Dave and for John Parada, that this really will not be a complete conversation if we're going to talk about Thanksgiving dinner without a Broadway Danny Rose reference and Frozen just as good. The banquet, Frozen Swanson, Frozen dinner that didn't Broadway Danny Rose serves. It's the greatest. It's one of the funniest scenes in a unbelievably hysteric movie. You'll always make a beautiful dollar in this business. For you. It's just so good. Yes, Lou.
I have not seen that in a long time.
Oh God, you got to be kidding! I mean, Dave Joseph has seen it. Dave Joseph sees it, I think, once a month, and Parada too. But nobody quotes it more than Dave Joseph. It's unbelievable.
I'll have to see if it's maybe streaming. Oh, speaking of streaming, I am going back a couple weeks. I will tip my cap to you for pointing me to the swimmer short story. Because after we got off the air, I thought, well, I knew it was based on something, but I never read the short story. So I went and read the short story, and then I did like a deep dive. And I'm guessing, you know, just my high school and college English classes didn't cover the swimmer, so I'd never read it. But I saw the movie without seeing the story. So now I'm kind of like, the story's very good. It's excellent, obviously. And I'm reading reviews and whatnot. And then I'm going back and reading the movie reviews, and people are liking the movie. And I'm thinking, did I not pick up what they were laying down in the movie? Well, I found it streaming on one of the free streamers. I'm sticking with my opinion on the movie. The movie is not good. The story is very good. And the reviews were very good. And I thought, why is that? And I think a lot of people just overlaid the story onto the movie. And, you know, hey, that brings the story to life. But the movie is far more literal and brutal. And you read the short story in about 10 minutes, and it's great and thought-provoking. But the movie is just, it's very literal and grim.
That's correct. And that's what makes it so devastating. I mean, with as affecting an ending as...
In the story, though, the story is not meant to be taken literally, very obviously. It's like you say, an allegory or a fable.
Right.
And that's tricky to do in a movie. So that's why I said, I have to go back and see if I missed what... But no, the movie is very literal. I mean, the story is clearly not taking place in one afternoon, but the movie clearly is taking place in one afternoon. So it just kind of knocked you over the head with, it was like 90 minutes of the guy in The Graduate saying plastics to Benjamin Braddock. I mean, it's like, hey, look how shallow all these people are. And that's a backdrop to the guy slowly going mad almost, which is a different tone than the short story, I thought.
Well, that's a cogent presentation, Seth, which we appreciate. Did you
former film school graduate? Like I say,
exactly.
I got into it.
Well, well, since you went in this direction, and I still do want you to give out a couple of plays at Keeneland. Did you catch yesterday, hour two, with Dan Delgado, with what he's doing with Let It Ride?
This is going to be very disappointing to you, because when I thought, well, another recommendation. I've never seen Let It Ride. And I immediately, when you put that out there about the podcast, I thought, let me see if that's streaming. And it's a streaming rental, so maybe I'll go do that. But people keep talking about it. I don't know why, but it just never has appealed to me as something I'm going to go out of my way to see. But maybe now I have to go. I have to go check it out.
Well, now you've just opened yourself. You've just opened. You're going to lose about 600 Twitter followers. This is... Oh, my God. I mean, especially because you're a candidate to be a background character in the movie. You're absolutely the perfect central casting type for this.
Well, the remake. I got a couple nephews out in Hollywood. I'll toss the idea out there.
Boy, Dan Delgado gave me the business because I said that that's pretty funny. We had this discussion, and I said that while I enjoy it, it wasn't necessarily my absolute, my absolute favorite. I mean, I can't sit through it. I'll tell you that. I find it too harrowing. It's got a breakneck pace to it. So when I enjoy it, it's in bits and pieces. I'll watch, I'll watch 20 minutes here and, 25 minutes there. Anytime, and any moment that Jennifer Tilly's on the screen, she just lights it up. I understand. I understand why everybody that loves it loves it. I understand, my sort of, I enjoy it. I got no explanation for you that you've never seen.
I don't know if they've made the ultimate horse racing movie yet. I'm a sucker. I'm a Frank Capra guy. I love a happy ending, and I'm a Frank Capra. That sums up. So to me, The Natural, which again, going between the movie and the material, is like 180 degrees. But I like The Natural as a baseball movie that hits it for me. Bang the Drum Slowly, also great, but. But a horse race, I will, at this point, I'll give it to Seabiscuit, maybe.
Farlap.
I give it to Seabiscuit just because it's lush and it's got the right production value. But yeah, I don't know whether they'd make the best one yet.
Well, the reason players love Let It Ride is that it's a play, and we discussed this yesterday. It's a player's movie. Did you hear yesterday's show?
I haven't yet.
Oh, okay.
I usually pull up and listen sometimes when I'm driving in. So.
All right. Well, then all right. Listen to that segment, the hour, and then watch the movie, and then the most remarkable thing is you're going to discover, if you weren't aware, because I wasn't, that there's these podcasts out there that are doing what Delgado is doing, which is a scene by scene. Every episode of his show is a scene by scene dissection of the film. And there's even further dissections that are each episode is 1 minute of screen time. His first guest, who's done this with Heat and with All the President's Men and with a few other movies, where he's literally had 160 episodes dissecting a film minute by minute.
I was going to ask you how they were doing an ongoing podcast. That's interesting, and I didn't know that. As a movie guy, I should be plugged in, because I'm always looking for podcasts. And I've done a lot of TV show, which they go episode by episode. TV shows I love. What we're talking, I just thought another horse racing movie I like, but I watched it recently because it's available on YouTube, and man, it's kind of dated. But I like Boots Malone quite a bit.
Well, that's the favorite of many, 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 many people. Mig loves it. Rick Hammerly, that's his favorite. There's no shortage of people that swear by Boots Malone. Well, we've managed to fritter away 2 hours and 58 minutes. Give us one play at Keeneland.
I'll rip just numbers through the late pick four.
Go.
2-5-10 with 3-4-7 with 746 with 311-1. Once again, 2-5-10 with 347, with 746, with 311-1. I think you can, you know, it's a cheap ticket, but maybe beat a couple of favorites in there.
Very good. There you go. $41, 81 multiples for Seth Merrow, folks. Seth, this was fun. Thank you. Go have yourself go get yourself a turkey sandwich.
I've got half a turkey in the refrigerator. I'll go liberate it right now.
Seth Merrow, everybody, preceded by Ed Martin from the RCI, Racing Commissioners International, with some HISA budget commentary. Sire Watch Pedigree Focus brought to you by Hill & Dale with Sid Fernando, Work Thoroughbred Consultants. And we started the morning with Dick Powell. A lot of fun today. Another 3 hours whistled by. Good luck if you're playing today, everybody. Back with you tomorrow, Thursday edition at the races. Talk to you then.
It's At the Races with Steve Beck on Sirius XM Radio.
Here in Pennsylvania, we're...